Hello and welcome to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. So on today's podcast, I chat with a very distinguished guest, someone who's designed a technique she believes can help learners of any language achieve near-native accents. Professor Karen Chung from the USA has lived in Taiwan for more than 30 years, and for most of that time has worked as a linguistics professor at the National Taiwan University. In 2018, a TED Talk which she delivered in flawless Mandarin received over a million views and brought her methods to the attention of a large international audience. In the video, she explains her accent training technique, which she calls the Echo Method. The method, which is based on her own learning experiences, takes advantage of our echoic memory. First, we listen to a sentence or phrase in our target language, then we wait for the audio to replay or echo in our minds, before finally mimicking it out loud. According to Karen, doing it in this way allows us to mimic native speech much more closely than conventional listen and repeat methods. In this podcast, we explore her own language learning journey, how she learned Mandarin to such a high level, and why she disagrees with the conventional language learning opinion that accents don't matter as long as we can more or less make ourselves understood. She also kindly agreed to give me a brief demonstration of her method to help improve my own Mandarin accent. Okay, so Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
Many people know you for your work as a professor of linguistics and also because you did a brilliant viral TED Talk outlining the Echo Method, which you developed to help language learners acquire native-like pronunciation. We're going to talk about that a bit later, but to start with, I wondered if you could take us back to the beginning of your Chinese learning journey, which I think was in 1970s Minnesota.
It actually didn't begin with Chinese in the 70s. That was sort of like the end of my search for my language. It started actually with my father when I was like 3 or 4 at home, and he would just teach me German at the dinner table. And my interest in language came largely from my father, who knew several languages. He went to a junior college in Wisconsin that was much like a German gymnasium, and he studied Latin and ancient Greek and Hebrew, and of course German. I'm only a second or third generation immigrant. So that was really where my interest in language came from. And also we happened to have a German class in our elementary school, which is unusual in America, but in Minnesota we had Spanish and German. Our school had German. So I always had it all along. And then around high school, I realized that when I went to the library, I was always going to the section about teach yourself Russian and other things like that. And I thought, I must be interested in languages. I thought I was interested in art or painting or something. No, I guess it's languages. So I became aware of that. But after studying a few Indo-European languages, I started with German, went through French and then Spanish, even tried Russian. My brother-in-law said, you know, don't just get stuck in West Europe. They were all just Indo-European and it didn't really get me excited. And then 1 year in my hometown in St. Paul, they had something called the Twin City Institute for Talented Youth in the summer. And for the first time, they offered a course in Chinese studies. And I thought, well, gee, I don't know anything about Chinese. I am going to try that out. And so I started going to the classes and I thought, I found my language, that's it. So that's where it started. And after that, it became sort of like a religion. At the beginning, it wasn't really systematized. I just found out I really loved Chinese. And so the following year, that was my senior year in high school, I started auditing Chinese classes at the University of Minnesota. And I just followed what they did. And I think it was a very good course. I stayed in touch with the teachers, and I think I learned well. But of course, you don't learn a language just by going to class and by doing your homework. You really have to get serious and you have to practice with a native speaker. So after my year of auditing in Minnesota, I went to Germany for a year. I was hoping I'd be placed with a Chinese family when I was in Germany. But actually, I was with a German family and I continued my Chinese practice on my own. Went back to Minnesota and then continued in Chinese. And I met a lot of Taiwanese and students from Hong Kong. And I spent almost every day with them. And that's really where it came from. You need the basis of formal, really organized, solid studies of classes, like university classes. But to actually cross over that barrier to speaking, you just need somebody who's going to be really, really tolerant and kind and help you.
In terms of the formal study and also the informal practice, would you say at that time you were focusing more on oral Chinese, on listening and speaking, or equally on both the written form, reading and writing as well?
Oh, I was definitely doing reading and writing, and that was probably the biggest part of what we did at the university, though we also had a lot of oral work. With my friend, it was just, we were hanging out, we were friends, we went bowling together, we went to potlucks, so we just spoke Chinese, and he had the patience to say, for example, like, when someone asked us what kind of eggs we wanted for breakfast, I said, 混蛋, which I thought was scrambled eggs, but it actually means an SOB. And they were laughing so hard, and I couldn't figure out what was so funny about scrambled eggs. So we went through many, many experiences like that. And I've heard that from every single language learner who's written about their experience. You have to get used to making stupid, embarrassing, ridiculous mistakes and just laughing with everybody.
Absolutely. At least with that mistake that you've mentioned there, it wasn't related to the tones, right?
No.
Which is usually one of the biggest issues that foreign learners have. But I'm wondering how you kind of tackled that in the earlier days. So when you were learning Chinese, how did you tackle the issue of Mandarin tones? What techniques did you use there?
Well, first of all, I was just totally fascinated by the whole idea. Because, like I said, when I was on my search for my own language that I kind of spend the rest of my life working on, I was so thrilled about, first of all, Chinese not having inflection. You know, I didn't have to worry about gender. I didn't have to worry about past tenses, all this other stuff. And the tones, to me, just tickled my fancy. I thought it was so interesting that you could change the meaning with tones. So I paid really close attention to them from the very beginning. And I don't think tones were a big problem. I think rhythm was a problem at some point. Like, I would say things, like, too quickly. I'd kind of rush through it with, you know, I wasn't taking every syllable seriously. So once I said, gong chan dang, and my friend said, no, it's not gong chan dang, it's gong chan dang. It just happened to be that word. This is not meant to be political, but that was the word where he pointed it out. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay, I need to pronounce each syllable clearly and separately. And so that helped a lot with my rhythm. And I think just being around it all the time, and getting funny looks. You have to be really sensitive to, like, people sort of just sort of like making a little frown, moving their eyebrows a little bit. You have to watch those things because that means something's wrong. And as soon as you see these tiny micro movements, you say, oh, what did I do wrong? And then they'll model it.
Yeah, that's quite important because often in Chinese culture, people are often very polite. They are less likely to kind of maybe directly criticize your Chinese, even sometimes if you ask for it. So looking out for those micro signals, I guess, is quite key as well.
That's right. And that's been useful in my teaching English in Taiwan. I said, you know, everybody is your teacher. It's not a cliche. When you're talking with someone, pay attention to all of this, you know, these facial expressions and all these gestures that you're getting, because they're giving you a lot of information that their mouth won't give you.
I'm fascinated by something you said about how you took tones very seriously from the beginning, and that tones were never a big problem for you. I tend to hear that from people who did take tones very seriously from the start, that it's definitely the best order to do things in, rather than the order that I did things in, which was to not take them seriously and then realize later on that my tones were kind of all over the place and have to go back and do the hard work of putting it together again. I wonder, like, though, what was that experience like at the start? Was it sort of, when you say you took them very seriously, what did that involve? Like, obviously, being able to produce them in isolation and then moving on to memorizing them for your vocabulary, or was it more a natural process of just picking it up naturally through immersion?
I think since I was always interested in languages, at least since I just, you know, before I discovered it, I was interested in languages. And I became pretty good at German, although I'd already learned a lot at home. Living in Germany, I think my German got pretty good. And then I lived in Mexico for a while. I think my Spanish crossed over to the other side, and that got pretty good too. So I was already really into paying attention to how people were really speaking, rather than listening to my own idea of how they were speaking, you know, my own stereotype of how it sounds. I'll give an example from a British friend of mine who was learning French. When he was in French class, he was a good student, but he was always saying things like plateau and massage. And he said them because they're borrowed words in English. And in British English, you don't stress the last syllable. We do in American English. And his teacher said, you know, you've got your stress wrong. It should be plateau and massage. And then he was kind of insulted. You know, why are you picking on me? I'm a good student. But that was something he had just missed. He brought in a stereotype from the way he pronounced them in English. And finally, a teacher told him brutally, you know, you're doing it wrong. And they thought, oh, yeah. And he started listening. He said, oh, yeah, now that you mention it. And so I think from the beginning, I was really alert to stuff like that, rather than using common stereotypes of how you should sound. You know, a lot of people end up with, you know, Matt versus Japan made this observation too. You end up with a national dialect or a national version of the language you're learning, especially with English. You notice it, like there's a Spanish version of English and a French version of English. There's a Taiwanese version of English. And people will often have that in their head as a model. It's their stereotype. And so when they speak, they're trying to match that stereotype that they hear all the time. It's not a native version. And to get them to break out of that and to actually use their ears, you have to jump into a different mode. You can't just use stereotype mode.
Absolutely. You mentioned Matt versus Japan, and something I'm quite interested in is when he came on the podcast, we talked about the similarities between acquiring tones in Chinese and pitch accent in Japanese. And I was recently watching a video with Matt versus Japan, who's been working on his own pitch accent for the last couple of years quite intensively. And he was talking with another elite Japanese learner called Dogen. And what they were discussing were that both of them had been learning for around about 10 years, and they'd taken pitch accent seriously for several years. And they both reached a point which is similar to where I feel I am in Chinese now, where I can speak with tonal accuracy, but there's a part of my brain which needs to actively monitor parts of my speech in order to make sure that I'm speaking with the right tones. And that takes more effort than, say, if I can just speak in English, like automatically without worrying about the pronunciation. I'm wondering in your case, now that you've been speaking Chinese fluently for decades.
Over 40 years.
Yeah, over 40 years. Does there come a point where it's completely automatic? You no longer need to think, am I getting this right?
Yes. And I've been thinking a lot about that whole issue because that's sort of like a wall you have to flip over. And it's very difficult. It's part of that process I described earlier of you have to have somebody who is really committed to you. You know, a boyfriend or girlfriend actually works well. Husband or wife does not. But or it could be a best friend, but somebody who you're with and who isn't always trying to practice English or whatever it is. So you really need that, you know, you have to start out with a solid foundation. You have to really do the work. And I really did. Like when I was in Germany, I was writing characters every day. So I was pretty prepared when I got back in university classes. You need that solid foundation of the theoretical knowledge and the practice that you can do on your own. But at some point, and it shouldn't be too early, like Matt said, because you'll often just make bad habits worse or more ingrained. At some point, you're going to have to get feedback with somebody, have interactions with somebody. And that's when you slowly will start to, you know, climb over that wall. Because I can remember it happening in Chinese, that incident with the Hun Dan. I was still in the process of trying to get there. And I was with this friend every day. We were traveling together. We went to Montreal together. And I was getting better. You know, I could start to have that feeling of just letting go and speaking, but I could only understand my friend, my supportive friend. So every time we were in a group, somebody would say something to me and I'd whisper to my friend, I said, could you repeat it please? And he would repeat the exact same thing and I understood it fine. So with his very kind, patient training, I had actually gotten to the point where I could understand him almost all the time unless it was a new word, but I couldn't understand anybody else. And then that was like another step, you know, in the path forward towards being able to let go and just, you know, listen and speak with understanding, listen with understanding and speak in a relaxed way. So after that, I realized that we needed to go to a lot more potlucks and parties. And I just had to be put in uncomfortable in an uncomfortable position of not always understanding other people. And then it slowly came, but it was step by step. Like I said, at first I only understood that one person.
Absolutely. After about 5 years, I think, you ended up moving to Taiwan, is that right?
Well, I started Chinese in, at the university, let's put it at 1972. Well, that was in high school. And then I moved to Taiwan in 1984, but I actually studied here for 2 years in 76 to 78, which was long before most of my students were born. So I had a year and a half as a student at the university here, and I continued like living in a Chinese bubble ever since then. And then I met my husband, and then we moved to Taiwan in 84. So basically since 73, I'd always been involved with Chinese people and using Chinese every day. I think I gained fluency in about 2.5 years. So if you put together the time I spent studying on my own and practicing with my friend, it took about 2.5 years.
One thing I'm interested in is there are a lot of viral videos online. You may have seen some of them, which say talk about like how I mastered Chinese in 6 months or a ridiculously short time frame. Anybody who's like taken Chinese seriously will find that kind of claim quite laughable, because Chinese is just not a language that you can, quote, master in a short period of time, even in a long period of time. There's always more to learn. But I'm wondering, a question that people always want to ask when they're starting out learning a new language is, how long will it take before you kind of feel you've been immersed in the environment for a long, long time? Do you ever get to the point where you feel like your comprehension skills can rival those of a native speaker in the language, or even rival your own comprehension skills in English? You can switch on TV, just understand everything.
Yeah, it does. 2.5 years, I could pretty much handle most stuff. So when I came to Taiwan as a student in 76, I had no problem at all getting along. So yeah, but like I said, I had a special situation. I had a really solid university program, and I had that supportive friend. Without that supportive friend, I don't know how it would have happened. So yeah, if you've got all of those things in place, you can do it. But you also have to be just so in love with it and so crazy about it and so dedicated that you work at it all the time. So my morning routine now, the first thing I do when I get up is I pull out a volume. It's entitled Strange Stories from a Chinese Studio. The Chinese is Liao Zhai Zhi Yi. It's written in classical Chinese. It's from the Qing Dynasty from the late 1600s. It's really, really difficult Chinese. And it's just like a thrill to be reading it, and it absolutely keeps you humble, because I have to look up tons of stuff and then find out about allusions, find out about cultural things I didn't know. And it's fresh and new every single morning, and this is after more than 40 years. Chinese will keep you humble.
I wanted to move on to talking about your academic career, because after you moved to Taiwan, at some point you began pursuing an academic career, and that's when you began developing methods to help foreign language learners acquire better pronunciation and accents. And throughout this process, your kind of philosophy has to some extent gone against the tide of current orthodoxy around the world, which is kind of to say that, you know, accents don't really matter. What matters is to get your pronunciation up to a point where you can be understood more or less. I've been told this plenty of times by tutors and Chinese people about like what my ambitions should be for Chinese. Why is this wrong?
Okay, this is like walking on eggshells to talk about, because it is just such a contentious issue. You know, back when I first started learning languages in school, they used the audiolingual method, which in fact is a good method. You know, people put it down now as something really awful, and we've moved beyond that. The audiolingual method was right. It doesn't mean that they actually executed it perfectly every time, but the idea was absolutely right. I don't care what anybody says, you know, just like Matt, okay, you know, attack me. That's what I'm saying. So it was quite a while after that, after I'd gone through most of my language classes, that the communicative method took over, which means just so people understand you, it's good enough, and then they put less emphasis both on pronunciation and, strangely enough, on grammar. So as long as you can muddle through and make yourself understood, it's good enough. And that was really a wrong turn as far as I'm concerned. You need some of that, because if you go traveling, you have to make yourself understood somehow, and you use any method you can. But that is not the way you learn a language well. You should not be in a panic position, always in an emergency. And that's why it's not so good to go to a language, to go to a country with no background in the language. I noticed that the year that I came to Taiwan the first time, those who had like a few years of Chinese, they did well. Those who came here knowing nothing, they just floundered. They were in terrible shape and they never learned Chinese very well. They learned panic Chinese. Speaking it so that other people can understand you with effort. That's why I use the Mark Zuckerberg recording in class as in the TEDx talk. Because when that came along, I thought, man, this guy's really a blessing to language learning. I don't mean to put him down, because the first reaction of the students is, wow, he's made such an effort to learn Chinese. We're so flattered and we're so proud of him. And I don't deny that. I'm very impressed. He worked very hard and he has come a long way. But his tones are not good. His intonation is completely English intonation. So I tell my students, if you want to learn good English intonation, listen to Mark Zuckerberg's lousy Chinese, because that will tell you everything you need to know about English intonation. He does everything in Chinese that we do in English that he shouldn't do in Chinese. And so I play it for my students on the first day of class, and I make them listen for a minute, like in the TEDx talk, and I say, okay, now, what are your reactions? And then a lot of them would say, I am so angry that you have wasted my time and my mental energy on this. This was so exhausting. They get angry. I say, okay, now do you know why I played this? This is not a Chinese class. And then they just look at me with this look of understanding. They say, that's how we sound to other people when we don't speak English with a good accent. In the past, I had a hard time convincing students that pronunciation mattered. But ever since Mark Zuckerberg, they are totally on board.
You know what? This is really interesting you say that, because one of the main motivations for me improving my Chinese pronunciation was when I talked to Chinese friends about it, and then some of them would tell me in very thick Chinese accents, don't worry about it. Your Chinese just sounds like our English does.
At least they have that personal insight.
not everyone
good.
Does. Yeah.
No, does. They don't.
There's a TED Talk, another TED Talk, not yours, which kind of goes completely against the grain of what you're saying. And it uses a catchphrase, which I think, if I remember correctly, is language is not an art to be mastered. It's a tool for communication. And I guess when I watched this TED Talk, it made a compelling case that if language is a tool for communication, you can get away with poor pronunciation, with using caveman-style grammar. For me, the most convincing argument is less to do with how difficult it is to understand, but rather that this strips away all of the beauty of language if you get rid of all of those aspects.
One thing that's really important is, what is your motivation? In everything in life, our brains are designed to save as much energy as possible. We're designed to conserve energy because our brain energy is just such a high investment. Everything that we use our brain for, we are actually using up our limited amount for the day, and that means we can't do something else. It's a zero-sum game. So if we are expected to use this very, very precious limited resource on somebody who has not gone to the trouble of trying to learn something better, and then now I can hear all of the protests. They say, well, some people are just not good at it. They can't do that. I don't buy that. Because I have found with the ECHO method that anybody, and I mean anybody, can learn good pronunciation. 100% native, maybe not, but really close. And it's enough that at least when a native speaker talks with you, you won't exhaust them. And as soon as I teach my students that pronunciation is all about respect for the other person, you're not doing it to show off, because sometimes you get like Taiwanese who go stay in the U.S. and they come back sounding really California and they seem really, really proud. I said, that's not your goal at all. You are just trying to make life easier for the person you interact with so that you don't steal their energy for the day. You make it easier for them to understand you, and that will make it comfortable for them. And in that way, they will start trusting you more. When they trust you more, you will feel closer, And how many things are there in life that we want as humans than to have trust with other people and become close to other people? There's not really much that goes beyond that. And once they understand that you are doing it out of respect for the other person, that actually really resonates with East Asians because their cultures are all about showing respect for other people.
In your TED Talk, which you delivered a few years ago, and which has since gone viral with over 1 million views, there were two things that stood out. One of them was that you spoke with this nearly flawless Taiwanese accent, which everybody's been commenting on. And the other one was that you outlined the technique that you've just alluded to, which is the echo method. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about how the echo method works.
Well, in my early years of teaching at Taiwan University, I thought I really knew what I was doing because, like I said, I've been doing languages my whole life. Like when I was a kid, I would play school. Like there was a family with a daughter who was mentally challenged, and I'd take her down to the basement and teach her. I mean, I've just always been doing this. So I thought that by the time I started teaching, at about age 30 or so, I think it was, that I knew what I was doing, and I know I was a major in linguistics. But then I discovered there were so many things I didn't know about English, because I would hear my students saying things in the oddest ways. I could understand them, but it was just off. For example, I'm going to the convenience store, and my reaction was, "What are you so excited about?" Because we don't say convenience store, we say convenience store. And they made these mistakes over and over again. "I'm going to go visit my boyfriend." I go, "What?" So I realized there was a pattern to this particular stress mistake. And I looked in the books and I found a really inadequate description of it. It's usually like one or two pages in the Intro to Linguistics book or in these English pronunciation books, and that's it. And so my students said, "Well, all right, you've noticed this. Can you give us a rule for it?" And then I said in Chinese, "知其然 or 不知其所以然," which means I know it's there, but I can't tell you why. I can't give you a rule. And then they said, "Well, would you please work on it?" So what I did is I worked on it. And then over the course of, I'd say, about 2 years, I cracked it. I figured out what the rules were because the rules seem to get broken often. Well, there are systematic exceptions, and then I worked that out. So at the beginning of teaching, there was just all this stuff going on, and I was trying to respond to my students' questions, thinking I knew everything, but I didn't, because I was learning from my students' mistakes. And then I realized that when I had them listen, repeat, doing it the right way, like it's convenience store, I would say, "Well, it's not convenience store." Before I even finished saying convenience store, they had already jumped in and started repeating. I said, "I'm not finished. You're not listening." And then they said, "Oh." And then I repeated it. And as I repeated it, I saw all these gears turning in their brains because you can see the eyes looking up to the right. You can see their forehead wrinkling. You knew that they were actually just rehearsing how they were going to say it when it was their turn again. They were not listening at all, which is the way a lot of us, you know, hold conversations with friends. But anyway, I could tell that they were rehearsing their own performance because Chinese speakers in both sides of the straits, they tend to be terrified of being called on, so that they will usually rehearse constantly in case they're called on, so they're ready. When you're rehearsing, you're not listening. And so I found that this was something I had to fix. And just listen and repeat was not good enough, because if you listen, you know, convenience store, if you repeat it too fast, you're not catching everything because you're just too distressed and too panicked about your own performance. Then I realized with my own learning, I was doing this anyway. I said, you know, we have something called echoic memory. If you hear any sound, speech as well, but it doesn't have to be speech. If you just hear a crash of a vase to the floor, you hear it replay in your head after it's crashed. So it's something that happens in our brains automatically. It is a type of auditory memory. And that means it's short-term memory. It only lasts for a few seconds. And when it's gone, it's gone. But it repeats every sound that we hear. You know, sometimes you can call to somebody in another room and say, "Well, can you tell me where the something is?" And then they say, "Huh?" And then they say, "Oh, never mind. I know what you mean." Because they heard it on the second playback in their head. So you don't have to repeat it. And everybody, I think, has had this experience. That's right. And that is echoic memory. And it's kind of amazing to me that this has not been exploited before, as far as I know, in language learning, at least not such that anybody's written about it or encoded it in a teaching method, which kind of amazes me because I'd always been aware of it. Once I got them to do that, and once I got them to relax and to not move their mouth or their tongue or their lips or scrunch their forehead or look up to the right, they just completely relaxed, focused on me giving them an audio signal, they got it. So I had this experience with a student from a very rural area in South Central Taiwan. He was in the medical school, so you know he wasn't dumb. But his pronunciation was just as rural as you could get. As it was just really, really as stereotyped and as really bad as you could get. I was like, okay, wait a minute, we're gonna fix this. So it took 20 minutes of class time. Using this method, I had him listen and echo and repeat just tiny, tiny phrase by tiny phrase. And then he pulled it together and he read this little paragraph. You couldn't tell he wasn't a native speaker. And he started from like really, really, really country bumpkin English. And he fixed it once he was listening and once he was focusing. Of course, once they go out the classroom, it's another thing unless they practice. But I found the power of it. Somebody who sounded just really hopeless and just with one of the most typical accents you could find, they sound like a native speaker immediately. It happens on the spot.
Is this method, do you think, equally effective for all languages?
Yes.
Obviously, what I'm getting at is, would it be effective for Mandarin Chinese? And I was wondering if you'd be up for doing a brief demonstration with me.
It's absolutely good for Chinese. It's especially good for Chinese because of all the problems we Westerners have with tones. So it's good for every language. What it does is that person's voice is completely internalized by your brain. So you can hear that person with their voice, not with your voice, your own voice or your own accent. It's that person's voice, their gender, their accent, everything comes in whole into your brain. But you have actually internalized it. So if you repeat after that internalized audio signal, you can do it nearly perfectly. Now, I say nearly because often you're not aware of some of the things you have to watch out for. I'll give you one little example. Like, 一年 in English is 1 year, but Taiwanese normally, and other Chinese speakers, normally will say 1 year. I don't know if you can hear clearly that it's a bit off. Can you notice what's wrong? 1 year. 1 year is my normal way to say it. 1 year is what you hear here.
Is it to do with the one and the vowel?
Well, the vowel has become nasalized and the N has been dropped. So instead of one with an N where your tongue tip touches your alveolar ridge, it's just one, you know, it's like you're speaking French or Portuguese with a nasalized vowel, 1 year. And a native speaker of English will hear it's odd, but they may not be able to put their finger on it. But if you are listening and repeating with the echo method, you may not catch all things like this because these are just so unconscious. It's an allophonic change in Chinese that you're bringing over to English. And we're normally not aware of all kinds of allophonic variation. So some things you need to point them out, and then it's much more effective. And then they can get up to native speaker level once they know what to watch out for. So anyway, to get back what you originally asked, I prepared a couple sentences from this new book I've just gotten. It's entitled Taiwan Mandarin, 50 Patterns Not in Your Textbook. So normally people learn Beijing accented Mandarin and things like Nishang Narchia, and you sound ridiculous if you talk like that over here. Unless you're really a mainlander, we let it go. But if you really speak like that, people will just kind of laugh. And in addition, there's political issues. So a mainland accent is really not what you want to go around speaking in Taiwan. So anyway, this one person, her name is Tai Peiting. She collected all kinds of grammar patterns that are common in Taiwan that are not in Beijing Mandarin. So I picked a few sentences from this book. And how about this one? Like, oh, I keep forgetting to bring my key with me. Okay, we'll say that in Chinese. All right, so we're going to divide it up into little chunks. I will tell you the whole sentence first. And then we're going to divide it up into little chunks And then I'm going to say the chunk, and then you definitely do not repeat after me right after I finish. You listen for the echo in your head. And when your echo is done, then you just repeat what your echo did. Okay? All right. So here we go. The whole sentence is, 我最近总是忘记带钥匙出门。That's the original sentence. So let's echo. I'll give you a little chunk. You echo it in your head, and then you say it out loud, okay? Here we go.
我最近。
Go.
我最近。
Perfect. All right. Usually you do it many times because it's not going to stick with just one utterance. People don't practice enough. They've done things once, they get tired of old material, and they move on. You're never going to learn anything well until you are willing to repeat something to the point where you feel like throwing up. Unless you've repeated it that many times, it's just not going to go into your long-term memory. It's just going to be stuck in your short-term memory for a while, and then it'll be gone. Okay, so we'll do it a few times and move on to the next chunk. Okay, so listen, echo, repeat.
我最近。
Go.
我最近。
我最近。
Go.
我最近。
All right, next chunk. 总是。
Go.
总是。
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 Beautiful.
忘记。
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 Mm-hmm. 忘。Maybe it's a more Beijing accent. 忘记。I have more of an ah in there, more back ah, but it sounds fine. It's perfect. Okay. So we'll put that chunk together.
总是忘记。
总是忘记。
Okay, you came in a little too fast, which means you probably thought, oh, I know this, I can ace this. Still wait for the echo to finish. And in the beginning stages, I need to remind students to do this. Once they have mastered that art of overcoming their urge to jump the gun, then they can get it in like one or two tries. But otherwise, you'll keep repeating it because you're covering the model by coming in too fast. You know, because the model hasn't finished playing in your head, you're kind of going to cover that with your own speaking. So be patient with it. Wait till the echo is really done. And then you can save yourself a lot of time. Okay?
总是忘记。
总是忘记。
That was much better. Let's do it again.
总是忘记。
总是忘记。
Yes. Okay, so the whole thing. Let's finish it. All right.
带钥匙。
带钥匙。
Beautiful.
带钥匙。
带钥匙。
Great.
出门。
出门。
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not men. It's not like men in English. It's 门. It's more of a schwa.
出门门门。
出门。
There we go. Yeah, okay. Echo again.
出门。
出门。
Yes, you changed it. The thing will be trying to make it a habit. So you'll pick up things when you're getting feedback while doing the echo method. And they're great at the time, but we really need to repeat things a lot to remember them, and also we have to remind ourselves of which things to watch out for, because you might forget that, it's not men, it's men. You have to really like write it down and then practice it. So let's just do larger chunks, see how you go.
我最近总是。
我最近总是。
忘记带钥匙。
忘记带钥匙。
Mm-hmm.
出门。
出门。
Okay, yeah. And after that, you start working on the whole sentence. So really, there are three levels. This is still just level one. We're doing it in chunks. And then level two, we can move on to larger phrases and then the whole sentence. And then level three, you do it synchronously with the model. So you do it together with the model at exactly the same speed with the same rhythm. And by that point, you keep repeating it, then you've really got it.
Perfect. I wanted to move on to a final question that I had for you, which is that when people hear you speak Chinese and with the accent that you have, which is very close to a native Taiwanese accent, many people will say, well, you're just talented. Is it true, do you think, that some people are just better than others at picking up foreign accents?
Of course, there are variations in ability. And I found that for a lot of things in life, I am not as fast as other people. I don't pick things up as fast, like maybe with ballroom dancing. I can learn it, but I'm probably going to have to work harder at it and work longer at it. But once I get it, I get it. Just because it takes you longer to get it doesn't mean that you're not as smart, doesn't mean that you're not as good, and it certainly doesn't mean that you can't learn whatever it is well. You may have to spend more time on it. So what? You need more time. You know, it doesn't make any comment about anything else. So if you are motivated, just take whatever time it needs and don't be intimidated by other people who seem to just pick it up with no effort. I found with some people, you know, back in my high school days, who picked things up really fast, they just forgot them completely later. They didn't take it seriously. They picked it up, they remembered it faster than I did, and they forgot it. So none of that really counts for much. The question is, are you motivated? If you're motivated, you'll find a way to do it. Take longer, you know, if you take longer, then take longer.
Well, that's a really positive note to end on, and I'm sure that many of our listeners will have taken a lot from you talking about your echo method and from also talking about your story of learning Chinese to a really high level, which is really inspiring. So once again, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you again so much for having me. I had a wonderful time. I hope we can talk more someday.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.